Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this chapter, Psalms 21, verses 1 through 13. The heading of the psalm is For the Director of Music, a Psalm of David. So this is one in a continuing series of Davidic psalms, starting in Psalm 2 all the way through here to chapter 21. It's for the director of music, so this is some kind of a song. The title I'm going to give it from the ESV is The King Rejoices in the Lord's Strength. We start now in Psalms 21, verses 1 through 2. David says, O Lord, in your strength the king will be glad, and in your salvation how greatly he will rejoice. You have given him his heart's desire, and you have not withheld the request of his lips. Selah. Now, when David says, in your strength the king will be glad, he's talking about himself, King David. And he says, in your salvation, how greatly will the king rejoice? That's talking about David's temporal salvation, because God was always saving David's bacon as he ran from Saul, as he was chased by Philistines, as he was chased by his own son Absalom. David constantly delivered him. That's what salvation means in this context, temporal salvation. Verse 2, David says, You, God, have given him, the king, David, you have given him his heart's desire. Now, I spent a long time in the previous audio covering Psalms 20, because David said the same thing there about getting his heart's desire. I made a big contrast between all those scriptures that say that God will make you prosperous and give you all kind of stuff, conditioned upon your obedience, of course. And then on the other hand, there were a bunch of verses that talked about suffering, getting sawn in two, Hebrews 11, Romans 8, all the affliction and tribulation and trouble that Christians have to go through. And I talked about how you reconcile those two ideas. One way is to say, well, in general, that's true, but not for every minute of your life, because you have to go through trials like Job did. He had to wait a while before he got his heart's desire. He got all his stuff back. But at a given point in time, you might be going through suffering. Or another way to reconcile it is, in general, we are blessed if we follow God as a group, as the Israelites were, as the Protestants were after the Protestant Reformation. Well, I'm not going to go through all that again. You can listen for a deeper discussion by listening to my audio on Psalms 20. And besides, this wasn't a promise that everybody would have his heart's desire if they follow God. David is talking about himself personally, and he says, yes, God has given me my heart's desire. He has given me the request of his lips. Now, if you think about what David has asked for mostly in the Psalms that we've gone over up to this point, his desire is to be delivered from enemies, because he had a boatload of enemies. And we will see that in this Psalm also. Let's turn now to Psalms 21, verses 3 through 7. David continues. He's praying to God directly. And by the way, this psalm is probably a musical psalm because it was for the choir director, according to the heading. For you meet him with the blessings of good things. For you, God, meet him, the king, with the blessings of good things. You set a crown of fine gold on the king's head. He asked life of you. You gave it to him, length of days, forever and ever. The king's glory is great through your salvation, God. Splendor and majesty you place upon the king, for you make him most blessed forever. You make him joyful with gladness in your presence. For the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. Now, of course, when David says he and the king in the third person, he's referring to himself. Normally that would be in the first person, but he's referring to himself in the third person. Now, in verse 3, David says that God set a crown of fine gold on his head. Is he talking literally or just symbolically? If he's speaking figuratively, fine gold is a figure for the highest royal prosperity, as Adam Clark says. He could be speaking literally, as Adam Clark suggests also. He suggests that that crown of fine gold might be an Ammonite crown, referred to in 2 Samuel 12, 26 through 30. Now Joab, that's David's general, fought against Rabbah, that's Rabbath Ammon, present-day Ammon, in present-day Jordan. Now, Joab fought against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon and captured the royal city. Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah. I have even captured the city of waters. Now, therefore, gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and capture it, or I will capture the city myself and it will be named after me. So David gathered all the people and went to Rabbah, fought against it, and captured it. Then, verse 30, 2 Samuel 12, Then he took the crown of their king from his head. That's the crown of the Ammonite king from the Ammonite's head. David took it off, and its weight was a talent of gold. A talent is a whole bunch of gold. And in it was a precious stone, and the crown was placed on David's head. So that could be what David is referring to here in Psalm 21. David said he asked life of you. I suppose in fighting all his enemies who were trying to kill him, David is asking for life when he says, God, don't let them get me. He asked life of you, God. You, God, gave it to the king, gave it to me. Length of days, forever and ever. Forever and ever, that sounds like David is eternal. Well, the NIV Study Bible suggests that David is actually referring to eternal life. I don't think so. Forever and ever, of course, can just mean for a long, long time, length of time. That's what the words mean there, olam. There are many instances when forever means a long time and not eternally. I'm not going to quote them for you because I've done that so often in so many previous audios. Now, the NIV Study Bible suggests that length of days forever and ever might be a figure of speech, similar to long live the king. In other words, the people would shout, may the king live forever and ever. And so David prays, let me live forever and ever, not really meaning it literally, but just meaning living for a long time. Adam Clark says that this refers to Jesus eternally because Jesus is David's antitype. I don't believe that. Some people have suggested that it's even a prophecy of Hezekiah. Remember, he was sick and asked for more time and was granted 15 years. That happened after King David's time. I don't think this was a prophecy of Hezekiah. That's really stretching credulity there. I think it's just easier to say that David is asking for a long life and God gave it to him, because if you recall, when he died before he turned the kingdom over to Solomon, he was an old guy. They had to put, what was her name? Abishai, I think her name was. The young girl, put him in his bed to keep him warm because he was old and couldn't stay warm. What an idea. I'm sure David loved that as he shuffled off his mortal coil. David continues in verse 5, his glory is great through your salvation. The king's glory, David's glory, is great through your salvation, God. Splendor and majesty you, God, have placed upon him. And that's true. David had a lot of glory. We're still talking about him today. Verse 6, for you, God, make the king most blessed forever, i.e. for a long, long time. You make him joyful with gladness in your presence. In other words, David, he goes before God. He doesn't cower like a frightened sinner, but he is glad because God is his father. David is joyful in the presence of God. He does not shake with fear. Now, this is assuming, of course, he hasn't sinned with Bathsheba or Uriah the Hittite or something like that, but just in normal times, he had a relationship with God. Verse 7, for the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. And that was true. Well, he got kicked out of Jerusalem during Absalom's rebellion, but he got it back. So, no, he never lost his throne. He was not shaken from his throne. Now, in verse 5, David says that the king's glory is great through your salvation. The king's glory is great. That sounds like he's bragging. He's talking very big about his glory. But notice that he immediately proclaims, David does, he immediately proclaims where his glory is coming from. And that is, it's coming from God. Because we read in verse 5, the king's glory is great through your salvation. That's why David has great glory, is because God has saved the king. God has delivered the king. And that's why David's glory is great. So he gives the credit to God. He always does. You recall in the first chapter of Psalms, when I was doing the audio, one of the common problems of the Psalms is the charge that David was self-righteous. No, he wasn't self-righteous. He was stating facts. God had given him a lot of glory, but it was God that did it, not David. David was a very humble man. He had plenty of reason to brag. He was a military genius. He was a political, I don't know if you'd say he was a genius, but he had a successful kingdom before he started screwing up at the end of his life. But he had a lot of reasons, especially at the first, before he got old, that he could have bragged about. Look at me. I'm the big shot in the Middle East here, in the ancient Near East. I'm a big shot because of what I've done. But he never did that. He always gave God the glory. We turn now to Psalms 21, verses 8 through 13, and we will finish this audio. David continues, your hand, God, will find out all your enemies. Your right hand will find out those who hate you. You will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will devour them. Their offspring you will destroy from the earth, and their descendants from among the sons of men. Though they intended evil against you and devised a plot, they will not succeed. For you will make them turn their back. You will aim with your bowstrings at their faces. Be exalted, O Lord, in your strength. We will sing and praise your power. Verse 8, David says that God's hand will find out all of God's enemies. God's enemies are always trying to hide from God, but they're unsuccessful in doing that because God will find them out. I don't care how dark the place is that they hide in. God's not stopped by darkness. He'll find them. David states the obvious here. Now notice David says, your hand, God, will find out all your enemies. David is assuming that David's enemies are God's enemies because, remember, he's been praying for deliverance from his enemies, and then he calls them your enemies. David has been talking about the salvation he gets from God in previous verses, and then he says that God will find out God's enemies, and so the implication there is that his enemies are God's enemies. That takes a lot of confidence in your relationship with God to say that. Verse 8, David says, your right hand will find out those who hate you. Of course, the right hand is the hand of strength. Whenever you see right, you think power, strength, authority. Most people were right-handed. That's where a soldier would typically hold a sword. Verse 9, David says, you will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger, like Sodom and Gomorrah. They were made as a fiery oven. This psalm sounds pretty imprecatory. Again, I'm not going to talk about that. David, as king, had a right to militarily and judicially whop his enemies, to shoot them with arrows, to burn them with fire. And he says, God's going to do it. I have no problem with that. If ever you have a problem with an imprecatory psalm, think about Adolf Hitler and think about what happened to him. If you don't jump up and down and scream and holler for the death of Adolf Hitler, there's something wrong with your theology. So in verse 9, the Lord swallows up his enemies in fire. Verse 10, there, that means God's enemies. Their offspring, you, God, will destroy from the earth. Oh, but wait a minute, that's not fair. How can offspring, who are sweet and innocent and who haven't done anything, how can they be killed by God? Well, no. The offspring are assumed to be doing evil just as much as the ancestors did against God and against God's anointed king. We read in Exodus 20, verses 5 through 6, you shall not worship them or serve them, the idols, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. And we read that and we say, oh, that's not fair. The third and fourth generations, they didn't deserve it. No, the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. The third and fourth generations were hating God just like the first generation was and the second generation was. So it's totally just. There's another verse, which I don't have in front of me, that says that God only punishes those who have committed the sin themselves, but not the children. I wish I had that verse with me, but I don't. That's another thing that needs to be reconciled. You see these verses as you go through. Well, this is the way to reconcile it, in my opinion, is that the descendants are doing just as much evil as the ancestors. And so David is not asking for an unjust result here. Verse 11, though they intended, your enemies, God's enemies, intended evil against you, God, and devised a plot, they will not succeed. And that's comforting to know because it sometimes seems as if they will succeed. But if you watch all those Nazi movies, the Nazis lost. The communists lost. Now, we still have evil people on the earth. We got communists in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, in China, in North Korea. But they will not succeed. They might cause a lot of grief before they go down, but they will be judged by God. And we have lesser evil people. They're not as bad as that, but they're in charge of America. God's going to whop them for their racist, bigoted, anti-white and anti-Semitic, anti-Asian selves. The radical left wing of a certain party whose name I will not mention. They will not succeed. Verse 12, David says, for you, God, will make them turn their back. You will aim with your bowstrings at their faces. Now, that seems sort of strange. You will make them turn their back, David says, in the first part of verse 12, which means the enemies are turned around and running. And then in the last part of verse 12, David says, you, God, will aim with your bowstrings at their faces. How is he going to shoot their arrows at their faces when God is looking at the retreating enemies' backsides? Well, it probably means that the bows were aimed at the faces first, and then the enemies turned their backs when they saw the arrows coming. In fact, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agrees with that and says the shooting against their faces would cause them to turn their backs in flight. The NIV translates it this way, you aim at them with drawn bow, doesn't mention you aim at their faces. They left that out, I guess, to avoid any sort of confusion, but we're not confused. That's easy to explain. David finishes up with a positive note here, as he always does in his Psalms 13, Psalm 21, verse 13. Be exalted, O Lord, in your strength. We will sing and praise your power. So that's one of the attributes of God that we should be thankful for, God's strength and his power, because that strength and power can be leveraged against those who would want to destroy us. If we want to make an application point there, after all, David is type of Jesus, and we're in Jesus, we're in his body. So yes, we can apply this to ourselves. We will sing in praise of the power of God to deliver us from our enemies, because by golly, friends, we have got a lot of enemies these days. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Psalm 21 on an uplifted note that prepares us to go to Psalms 22, which we will entitle, Why Have You Forsaken Me? Now this is a psalm of the suffering Messiah. It's a very famous psalm, so we'll look at it next time. I hope you stay tuned for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.